This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Sarah Mayer Cox, lecturer at La Trobe University. Good morning.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Do we just choose to blame fairies for everything?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where they originate from. So in ancient sort of pre-dawn, when they were really basically metaphysical beings and they're minor deities. So you can't be you can't have too many big gods. You got to have some little gods.
Oh, so when you say minor deities, so you've got the big gods up there.
The big gods up the top.
Yeah.
And then you have the little deities or the sort of the nymphs and the sprites and the little creatures that inhabit rivers, lakes, pools.
And thus Shakespeare used them.
Well, Shakespeare does use them in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
So that's when he sort of, as all good writers do, they draw on our cultural bank of stories, and he picked, you know, in Midsummer Night's Dream to set, you know, to have this sort of story half set in reality and half set in the fairy world. And the reason it happens at Midsummer is because there's that portal at the solstices and the equinoxes when there is a chasm or a split that opens between the other world and our world. So, but then it's also a way of explaining things that can go wrong and things that can go right. So
a good example of that is the text that I just received. My daughter cut her hair early one morning whilst in her bedroom. She blamed the hair-cutting fairy that had come and done it in the middle of the night.
Absolutely. And she probably did. So that's a modern interpretation of what fairies do.
Mm.
But fairies, in the same way that, you know, pre-Christian, ancient people believed in these gods of fertility, gods and gods of war and all the different things to explain natural occurrences, then some of these minor deities explain things like, now I'm best, you know, I'm most familiar with the sort of Celtic traditions, and the thing is that, of course, every culture has their own group of characters that fit into this sort of archetype. For instance, the concept of a changeling, and we see that a lot in Scottish literature, and most recently in pop culture, it's played out in Diana Gabaldon's Outlander series.
Yep.
You know, the idea that if you had a child that was born and it had some deformity or it was ill or it was sickly, you put it in a crook of a tree and the fairies would come overnight and would change the baby because give back the baby that you should have had, because clearly you had had a changeling child born to you.
Mm.
So that was a way of explaining away the grief and that sense of you've had a child that's sort of not quite right in the sense of the time back then.
Was there always a cost?
Oh, absolutely, there was a cost. And this is what we don't quite have today, because we've really simplified and trivialised the concept of fairies, largely because of Mr. Disney and all his wonderful
Disney
work.
Again.
Disney again. Because, yes, there always was a cost. So they would do something for you. But in one way or the other, it was, you know, that classic, be careful what you ask for because you might just get it.
Yeah.
It's just you won't get it in the way that you think you were going to. And there were also stories of warning. So a lot of those stories to do with, you know, not drinking from pools of water or rivers, because otherwise, some creature will come and then there'll be retribution later on. It's just straight out water safety.
Yeah, yeah.
If you think about it, because, you know, people didn't really, they weren't great swimmers back then. So there's always a reason for it. And people just choose different ones to, well, really suit the story that they're trying to tell. And these stories have been told for, you know, forever, basically.
The one that many of us probably know more, and if you want to ring 1-300-800-222 as we talk about fairies, if you want to talk about some of the older stories associated with fairies and how there is the mischievous and the good side, or fairies in literature as we know it today, 1-300-800-222. Most of us know the story in Peter Pan with Tinkerbell the fairy.
Absolutely.
So that has been sanitised through Disney to Tinkerbell only does really good things.
Because...
But originally, she not?
No, because, well, if you go back to J.M. Barrie's original story, which was a play, Tinkerbell very much, you know, she's a feisty female character, just as Wendy is a feisty female character. And it is that idea of J.M. Barrie uses her to... I mean, it's straight out dogma for children. Oh, every time you say I don't believe in fairies, a fairy will die. And it's him trying to keep that magical sense of wonder alive that children have. Now, when we have a look at the Disney version of it, it's right back to that that archetype he's created with the cinched waist, the elongated legs. In her case, she has the pixie cut. She doesn't have the big, massive sort of hair extension type hair. but she is, you could argue she's highly sexualized. And even though a lot of these metaphysical beings were highly sexualized, there is a sense that she's really sort of been toned down a bit. So she does have the mischievous streak.
She has, and she's always getting at Wendy and trying to make her...
Oh, she hates
it. She's not very nice.
No, well, she's not, because she wants Puck. She wants Pan.
Yeah.
And, of course, Pan is every boy, Pan meaning every. And so it's that triangle of, is he going to stick to the sort of the mother figure, or is he going to go for the slightly dangerous, wild figure?
How was she drawn originally? There's no drawing of her.
Everybody has configured her differently.
Okay.
And this is the other thing. Of course, they're all originally oral tales, so it would depend on how Trevor, who rolls into camp that night, and his version of what the particular creature looks like. And then, of course, in every area and every ethnic group, they have their version of what the characters look like, and that their particular penchant for wreaking havoc in your life or granting favours in your life.
And because of Disney, we automatically associate fairies as being girls.
Yeah, absolutely.
As female, but not necessarily true.
No, not at all. Not at all. Many of the characters are, and this is where if you talk about fairies in terms of it being F-E-A-R-I-E-S, so coming from the original sort of French
How
word.
How do you pronounce that? Fairies.
Fairies. They are the sort of almost demons, not in terms of the satanic demon word that we associate with it today, but that idea of the other, the mischievous, the unknown, that step into what we can't quite work out about the other life.
You know, this is a good point from Annette, who says Rapunzel, because this is as soon as you said there's always a price to pay, was Rapunzel actually a fairy, or it's just taking the idea and concept of fairy and putting it into another story?
Yeah, so Rapunzel is in, you know, what we would... So she is a folk and she's in the folk and fairy tale traditional literature's tradition. And Rapunzel, no, she's representing a woman who basically has no power in her life.
Yep.
But you could argue that the witch who's cast the spell on her is a malevolent fairy. And if you think about a lot of the fairy stories, which don't always have fairies in them, but if you think about Sleeping Beauty and the godmothers who are called to the christening and then the one that's ignored. And the price that she pays is that, you know, on her 18th birthday, she'll prick her finger and sleep for 100 years.
Yeah.
So there is that sense of annoy them and you really will cop it.
Who was one that had to spin gold?
Oh, Rumpelstiltskin.
That's one I think of. You see, I think of Rumpelstiltskin as a fairy.
He would come under that category.
Because there was a price to pay for him.
There is a price to pay. And he is that thing. He's a little, like, physically diminutive person. And so there's a good example of a male one.
Yeah.
And he would now Arne Thompson, who sort of cattle. Well, there were a group of people who set out in the 1800s to catalogue everything. The Grimm brothers sort of were starting to do it in Germany, or the Germanic states.
Sarah Mayer Cox, lecturer at La Trobe University in literature and children's literature, is with us, and we're taking a look at fairies now. We have to broaden this out in a way, Sarah, in that we associate fairies as one thing, but there are things like goblins and gnomes and all sorts of other things, which we may get confused sometimes with fairies.
Mm, mm. So they all come under this sort of broad category of, if you think about them as sub-deities and they just have little different names and different degrees of helpfulness, malevolence, and particular things that they're known for or responsible for in the natural world.
We were just talking in the news about, so if you take a look at those attributes, then we start to give it with fairies. And we were talking about Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And what's his name?
Dobby.
And Dobby. So he would be a fairy.
Yeah. But so his particular version, he's a household spirit. And so what J.K. Rowling has done, and this is what all good authors do, they don't necessarily reinvent the wheel. They take something that's really well known and, you know, it's like polished river pebbles and people are familiar with them and then they put their own twist on it. So you could almost say that Dobby would come from the line of brownies or brunies, the Scottish household little creatures that do things to help around the house when you're not aware.
Hmm.
Now, that my feminist spin on that is that's the, you know, because things, you'd go to bed at night and in the morning your house would be tidy and everything would be put away and all the rest of it. Well, if that's not the mum, I'll go hey.
It's not. It's the housekeeping fairy.
Yeah, a.k.a. mum. And, of course, the classic thing is that the mothers aren't stupid. They say, well, if you don't put out what the brownie needs, then the milk will go sour and the cows won't produce good milk. You know, they'll turn for the day and the eggs won't lay, the hens won't lay, and all of this stuff will happen.
If you don't,
and the subtle undertext to that is basically happy mother, happy wife, happy life.
Pick up your shoes, put them in the cupboard, do the dishes, make sure it's done.
Or I'm happy to do that stuff, but in the morning this is what I expect you to do.
Yep.
So, but of course what J.K. Rowling's done in sort of post-feminist times is Dobby is a male, and if you have a look at all the house elves, they're all males, they're not females, and she's put a different spin on them. So they're not malevolent, they are in servitude. So, of course...
And no wings. We'll come back to the wings in a minute.
You don't have to have wings.
Hello, Val.
Good morning, Trevor. Look, I'm 77 and I remember school, there was a story in the Reader, now this is going back at least 70 years, and it was called The Water Babies. Now, weren't they babies that died and lived under the water, became fairies? I'm struggling to remember.
No, you've got it bang on.
They were.
And Charles, I always forget his name, Charles Kingsley Smith, I think. I can't remember if he was the author or the illustrator, but absolutely sumptuously illustrated books, which started to come out sort of late 1800s into the 1900s. Beautiful colour plates in these collections of stories.
And they were good, evil, kind. That was part of the changeling thing as well.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go, Val.
Thank you.
Did you like the stories?
It scared me a little bit.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Because now we think, we can't have scary stuff for children, everything is saccharine. And, of course, those stories were always designed, they weren't initially told for children.
Mm.
They were, and you didn't have childhood. That's a Victorian construction,
yeah, that's true.
Number one. So everybody was aware of them. And, yeah, there were things that you had to be scared of and wary about in life.
Well, because otherwise you fell for that.
That's
and
right.
you could get hurt.
Mm.
Irish myths had fairies as a race of, as of races preceding the Brythonic Celts,
yep.
arriving at about 2,500 years ago.
Yep.
What does that
and
mean?
What it means is that they were considered to be a completely different race of people.
Oh, okay.
But they were a metaphysical race. They usually lived underground, and they had entry into the spirit world.
Are they like elves?
Yeah,
elves
well,
are
the
different.
Elves. No, no. It's all the same. It's
all right.
Just different. So the elves come from the Norse tradition, but it's the same concept.
Well, why didn't Tolkien put fairies in there? He got
because
elves.
He put elves in instead.
Oh, okay.
Because Tolkien drew very much from the Norse tradition, and back then that would have mashups.
There won't be any of that.
Well, that. Not for Tolkien.
Okay.
No.
Beryl, good morning.
Oh, good morning, Trevor. I remember when I was about 10, I received a book for Christmas, Grimm's Fairy Tale, and I loved it. I read it over and over again, and I love reading to my fairy tales to my children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. But now that my eyesight isn't the best, I am going to... I listen to the book readings on the radio, and I'm going to get CDs of book readings.
That's a great idea because you can also share them with kids as well. But why the Grimms call them fairy tales? Were there fairies within the Grimms' stories?
Sometimes, but really they were collecting folk tales. So the Grimms brothers were lawyers and, long story short, they basically realised that there were all these women around where they lived, in what we know as Germany today, who were telling all these stories, and they were going to be lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went about cataloguing and collecting these stories. But because they came from a Calvinist background, they sort of wrote out any of the naughty bits and they wrote in or they subtly massaged the stories so that there was enough sort of religion in there without it being the Christian God.
Can you get the uncensored version? Can you get versions?
Yeah. And
what's an example of the... I mean, we don't want to be ribald on the program.
Oh, well, there are many of them. So there's a lot of those stories. So spoiler alert. Turn off for 2 seconds. There's lots of incest in the stories. There's lots of bestiality in the stories.
Crikey.
There's lots of adultery in the stories.
No wonder they cut those bits out.
Oh, well, you can't have those, and especially not for children.
So does that mean, I'm trying to think of things like, what is it called, Naughty Rhymes?
Well, that sort of evolves later on.
Yeah.
Because
Revolting Rhymes and that sort of stuff
By Roald Dahl.
By Roald Dahl. Yeah. He's actually just brought back some of the naughtiness that was probably taken out.
He has, yeah. But what he's done is he's updated it for the time that he was writing in. So that's what happens every now and again, these stories are remade and recast for the times that we're living in.
Text saying, hi Trevor, Shirley Barber writes and illustrates beautiful books about fairies, modern and older.
Yeah, she does. And so she follows down the track and of the benevolent fairies.
Yep.
But she doesn't trivialise them. But that, but it is that idea that that in Shirley Barber's world, you know, and remember you can get the Shirley Barber doonas and pencil cases and all of that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Fairies wear mauve and pink. And
you want them to be nice and cute.
Yeah.
And not be scary.
Yeah.
I like the scary idea. Robin, good morning.
I went to school at Fums.
Sorry?
I said, I went to school at Fums.
It sounds like you went to school with some leprechauns or some brownies.
No, no, I went to school at Fums and saw the little minister and all those things at G.M. Barry.
Oh, I see. And you know what he's talking about.
Yeah,
I haven't got a
clue. Yeah, because the accent gives it away.
Oh, okay. So the Scott.
I was brought up in the same town as he was.
Ah.
So are you aware of brownies?
I am.
Which were the ones that you enjoyed the most as far as the stories that were told?
Oh, you go to Victoria and you go to Castleton and you get the Kelpie dogs, Kelpies.
So I'm nodding.
Yeah, you're
so
nodding.
Tell me what you know about the Kelpie dogs.
The Kelpies are water sprites.
Yeah, horses.
Oh, really?
Mm. Yeah.
So, which is where, you know, some people would argue that the story of Loch Ness would come from.
Loch Ness was invented to fool the poms.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Absolutely. But drawing on the idea of Kelpies, the water sprites.
So is that where we get Kelpie dogs from, Robin?
Aye.
In what way? How does it transfer from being water sprites to dogs?
A Kelpie is a water sprite.
Good. And what are some of the other ones that you're aware of?
Oh.
What about banshees?
Fairlies.
The what, sorry?
Fairlies.
Fairlies?
Yeah, that's a fairy.
Oh, okay. A banshee's fairies?
Yep.
Fairly.
But they're sort of, I've got to move on because it's a bad line that we've got you on, Robin, but thank you for telling us about them. Because banshees, don't they scream at night?
I always describe myself as screeching like a banshee.
But weren't they really
evil? I was
clearly
a banshee in my last life. Well, banshees actually, originally, they're not necessarily considered to be evil, but they herald your death. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So when you are about to die, you have a banshee assigned to you, and that is, you know, sort of like a spirit guide almost into the next world. Yeah.
So not necessarily bad, but because death has been so associated with terrible things, which in some ways it is, but it isn't necessarily in this case.
No.
It's a guide that actually helps you.
And in modern times, we marginalise death.
Mm.
Whereas if you think of these pre-industrial people, which is where all these stories come from, death was an everyday occurrence. You were always losing a child, a family member, and you were living in intergenerational families. So death happened much more. You didn't put your old people in an old people's home.
Yeah.
And if you had a disabled child and you hadn't put it in a crook of a tree, you know, you were living with all of these things. You had to explain it. It was before we understood DNA and different disorders and that happen. And so because we're still a very ancient people and we're coming out of that sense of seeking explanations outside ourselves. It's way before people were existentialist.
Yeah.
Then you have to look to someone else to thank, to blame, to explain.
But I associate the Kelpie was the pet name of the first of her breed in Victoria. Oh, I see. That's the Kelpie dog. Mm. The Shetland sheepdog is also known as Pierie, fairy dog.
Yeah, because if you think about it, I imagine, and obviously I'm not the person that named the Kelpie, but it's choosing to acknowledge the helpful side of it.
Yep.
And Kelpies, you know, we know when they're trained, they're absolutely fantastic, but they're shocking with our washing, aren't they?
So they've got the evil side.
You know, that's the evil side of it.
Baron, good morning.
Oh, good morning, my friends. How out there?
Good.
I was just wondering, from my point of view anyway, I think a fairy is just as good as your imagination. At the end of the day, reality shows what it is, what it is. At the end of the day, it's just a fairy is as good as your imagination. And look at the statistics show that probably like 70, 80% of the population of children are into fairies, not the adults. And the adults put the fairies into the children's brains from the beginning. So it's a toss of the coin, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's also a cyclic thing as well.
Mm. Well, it's it's an exciting thing to put your children through. I mean, you just have to see what's on TV these days and what's in fictional books and everything like that. I mean, if you want to look at the statistics from the old days, yeah, well, you can go back to medical things and people causing trouble with their tongues. So, you know, over the period of times, I think we've changed that logic into little people and fairies because it's more inviting to the children and not so scary in a sense of the word.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about, the idea of that if we're going to have fairies, that they've been changed into being pretty little things with wings.
Mm. But they also do, and this is what, when we've talked about this before, the idea that traditional literatures really account for the psychology of human nature and the sort of... you can also do Marxist readings of folk and fairy tales to account for social structures in life.
Mm.
But if you go back to the psychological readings of folk and fairy tales, it's really acknowledging the dark side and the light side, which everybody has. And we're all complex creatures. And it's how do we come to terms with who we are and the sort of normalising the things inside us. Well, you know, millennia ago, when we didn't have psychology as we know it today and psychiatry, we had wise women and we had storytellers, and the combination of the herbs and the stories helped wherever they could.
Someone said about the tooth fairy. Can you explain why it is that the price has gone so much up for teeth and why tooth fairy is so greedy?
I would say that is... parents overcompensating and feeling
they have
to. 5 cents
it used to be.
Well, yeah, and my kids, I thought our tooth fairy was very generous and coughed up $2 for a tooth.
Yeah.
Which when you've got three children.
That's still a lot of bucks.
Adds up.
Shouldn't be. If anyone wants to know about the going rate for tooth fairies for teeth, nothing over $5. Because if you do more, then the word spreads.
Five, that's paper. That's
word spreads.
Yeah, I think
so. It has to be a coin, doesn't it?
I think it should be a coin.
Because tooth fairies.
Tooth fairies.
They don't carry notes well.
They don't. It slips out of their little leather pouches.
1-300-800-222 or text us on 0437-774-774. Give us a ring if you want to talk about fairies in all of their different forms, whether it be we take a look at goblins, we've had a look at elves and all sorts of things. 1-300-800-222 is the number to call.
David Astle.
We've heard about nanoseconds, but an onosecond, we all know viscerally.
That sinking pit in your stomach.
Speaking of sinking, one of my onoseconds was a very romantic rowboat expedition in my 20s. I took a bottle of wine, took a bunch of grapes, and thought, I'll just rinse the grapes.
Oh, no.
Did you know grapes sink?
David Astle.
Monday to Thursday nights from 7
on ABC Radio Victoria.
Sarah Mae Cox joins us, lecturer in children's literature at La Trobe University. We're taking a look at fairies. If you want to try and modernise it and talk about some of the modern day fairies as we take a look at the idea that fairies do good deeds, they pay you back if you don't do the right thing by them. 1-300-800-222 is the number to call. Where do we see them in modern children's literature?
There's a real movement that's going on now, probably over the last 10, 20 years, where people are going back into traditional folk and fairy tales and doing modern spins on them. So they're taking traditional figures and different creatures from within the sort of fairy realm or the realm of the fae, F-E-Y, and they're moulding them to their own needs.
So like we saw in Harry Potter.
Yep.
And similar type things.
Yep, absolutely. And one of you, I know I've mentioned it before that I'm a Selkie tragic. So the Selkies are, of course, the figures, they're seals in their natural state, and then when they come ashore, they take the form of a human and they leave their skins behind. One of my absolute favourite books ever, ever, ever is called The Folk Keeper. We were talking about it before, Franny Billingsley. And it's the idea of this girl who, folk keepers, so they are the servant children, usually orphans, who have some sort of power, and usually they're boys. And they're allocated to different households in the Celtic realms. And their job is to sit in the cellar and to keep the little folk at bay, to stop the milk from curdling, to make sure that the cows don't go off, that the hens lay, you know, all of that stuff.
So they look after them, make sure that they do a good job.
Yeah. So in this particular story, the girl, and they're always boys. And, of course, because this is a postmodern story. In this particular story, Corinne, she's a girl, Corinna, but she takes on, cuts her hair short, runs away. She realises she's got this affinity with the fae, and she takes on this life of being a folk keeper. And because she has this really quite vicious streak to her as a person, she's really able to keep the little folk at bay. It's just absolutely wonderful. And it's a story that you can read to children sort of from grade six up. Just magical.
$20. Some of the tooth fairy ripped someone off.
Oh.
$4,000 for braces.
Yeah. That's the orthodontics fairy.
They generally get good holidays out of that lot. Yep. Patricia, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to put in a plug for Australian fae folk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good.
And particularly, I was brought up on the Burnett River in Queensland and many, many years ago, and although we were taught to swim very, very early in our lives, because my mother was terrified we'd get down to the river, the bunyip featured highly in our childhood, and that kept us away from the river without adults if we skived off. And really, the bunyip has featured very much, my understanding, of course, through Aboriginal law, and then was picked up by, I guess, early Caucasian settlers. It certainly featured highly in my family and family of my forebears to keep us away from water.
Yeah, Patricia, thank you. Hang on there, because, Sarah, we're going to talk about the Indigenous culture and where they come through, although we have been talking about Indigenous cultures in some ways, but in Australia, in Indigenous culture, whether or not there are fairies in the stories.
Yeah, well, I mean, we would call them fairies. Aboriginal people would have different names for them, but they perform the same basic job in society.
I think Gudacha, the Gudacha man was a He was a scare. That sort of stopped people from going out at night. There's all those sorts of stories.
There are. And it's beautiful. There are so many tales that that have been interpreted first by non-Indigenous people and now beautifully stories told by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander writers and you know, really blending today's cultures with dreaming stories and the supernatural creatures. And I think a lot of people, Bunyips came into Australia's consciousness, especially in the 70s when the Bunyip of Berkeley's Creek was done. But that spin on Bunyips was not a warning against water. It was the concept of who am I? What's my identity?
See, Bunyips I associate not having human form.
No, they
and
don't.
When I think of fairies, I think of, even though they can be wicked and they can be goblin-like, but they still have a human form.
Yeah.
And is that one of the things that is associated with fairies, that they have some sort of human form?
Yes. Although, yes, I think you could argue that.
Yeah.
And I think that's why if you have a look at, you know, trolls and dwarves and different things, they have much more sort of exaggerated features to them. And then, of course, what happens is that in the same way that authors will take a theme and follow it through the years, illustrators do the same. So once you get an archetype of elves all have pointy ears, it's very hard to break away from that.
The story of the borrowers, which is a fantasy story, is that the same sort of idea?
No, slightly different, because that's fantasy, and the borrowers, the idea of their little people that live under the house and everything that goes missing has been taken by the borrowers. So Norton wrote that book, in the 40s or 50s maybe?
In the 50s, yeah.
And I mean, that's fantasy, but it's a different sort of fantasy. And it probably, you could draw a long bow and say it originally comes from that tradition. But, of course, every now and again what happens is we have a shift and someone will run with an idea based on supernatural creatures, and that steers things in a completely different direction.
When you think of, because whenever you think of fantasy things in Australia, it always comes back to Snugglepot and Cuddlepie eventually.
Yeah.
Of that, would it be the Banksia men who are the fairies?
They're the, well, yeah, so they are considered to be the malevolent creatures. And But Snugglepot and Cuddlepie, you could say, are the fairy creatures.
But then Snugglepot and Cuddlepot don't do anything mean. The only mean people are the Banksia men.
Yeah, they are. But again, so there is an example of May Gibbs splitting it, because you don't, you know, you might scare children if you have characters that are like you, but you do naughty things. So the idea is that you don't want to be like a Banksia men. You want to be like Snugglepot and Cuddlepie. You can be mischievous. You can do naughty, fun, happy, la-la things, but you can't be a Banksia man.
You can't draw on the wall with text.
Not really, no. Not unless the wall text of fairy has done it.
I like the idea of the wall text of fairy. Look, and so when you take a look at that, because we were talking about the Smurfs a little bit earlier as well. I mean, they, in some ways, did good by actually, well, they were underground and wombling. Yep. Oh, no, the Wombles, too.
Oh, the Wombles. Yeah, that's
with
again.
No. Oh, come
that's
on.
That's fantasy. Well, okay, so you can trace them back and you could say that they are...
They recycled.
They're environmental brownies. Okay? That's how I'll draw the bow there. And I adore the Wombles. I grew up with the Wombles of Wimbledon Common. Won't break into song now. But, of course, brilliant stories. And again, you take these stories, use them as a vessel to pour into your ideas. So, hey, let's get with the program and start to recycle.
Isn't it good, though, that you can do that, that you can have such a rich vein of story to draw from in the original fairies, and you can take those little bits of concept and use them into other places?
Yeah, and that's why they just keep popping up again and again.
Jeff, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. How are you?
Good, Jeff.
From my childhood, or many years ago, I remember a story called The Nagin and the Stars.
Patricia Wrightson.
And in more recent years, it was adapted into stage, and I took my own children to go and see that story, and I understand that the creatures in that story are actually based on Indigenous legend as well.
They are, and Patricia Wrightson, who is acknowledged to be one of Australia's finest writers, sadly not with us anymore, but she had specific permission to use and dip in and out of Indigenous storytelling.
Oh, that's
terrific. But she made it, two things she made very clear. She had permission to use specific characters, and she only ever used what she called the small figures. She never touched big magic and sort of initiated stories. And I think in the, when I speak to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander authors and peoples, they're actually really happy for non-Indigenous writers to make use of those figures because it brings it into the mainstream.
It's reconciliation.
Well, it is reconciliation, yep. Literary reconciliation.
As long as you're recognising the
absolutely.
Culture and attributing the culture.
That's right. And as long as you get permission to use those stories and you acknowledge it in author notes and in other ways. So, for instance, you know, Kate Constable's wonderful story, Crow Country, and Kate is a non-Indigenous writer. It really blends beautiful storytelling of Aboriginal myth and legend of Kaa, the crow figure, but weaves it through into a modern murder mystery story. So absolutely brilliant story.
What is it that you liked about them, Jeff?
Oh, look, I think those stories really felt homegrown. We're all Australian, and as a kid, I just remember thinking, you know, it was almost like a sense of pride that these are the legends of this country. And likewise, my kids also became quite entranced with them as well.
But yeah. They're intriguing. I remember I had, and I've spoken to you this about before, I had a children's book of Indigenous stories when I was 10, which would have been in the late 60s, early 70s, Jeff. And I just found them intriguing and wonderful to read because they were good stories.
Yeah, that's right. No, agreed. Absolutely. No, thanks. I really enjoyed this section tonight.
Good on you. Thank you. And I can't even remember the book. I just remember the image of two children flying up towards the moon.
Yeah, you probably were looking at the Dick Ruffsy, Percy Tresize books.
Okay.
So that was a partnership between.
It's a hardcover.
Yeah, hardcover. Oh, yeah.
About that big?
Square. Mm. And beautiful, Indigenous art in the naive style.
Yeah.
And they were modern interpretations of traditional stories. But it was a pairing of an Aboriginal man and a white author. And so
that was big for the like 60s,
early 70s. Huge. Oh, Australia was punching above its weight in the 60s and 70s and from then on.
Pam, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, Pat.
I just wanted to talk about beautiful Enid Blyton stories that are full of gorgeous fairies, like the Faraway Tree and the Wishing Chair.
Of course.
Yes, and also Peg Maltby, who is an Australian illustrator and author, and she has written the most beautiful and illustrated the most beautiful books. I was given one for my third birthday, and I still have it, and it's simply gorgeous.
Thank you.
Yeah, look, Peg Maltby was one of Australia's early illustrators, and such a distinct style. I mean, you could look at them now and say they sort of trivialise fairies, but it's a very, very distinct style from the time, really beautifully drawn, and given as gift books to to many people. Yeah. And the artwork now is collected. It's very valuable.
Thank you. I keep forgetting about Enid Blyton because whenever I only think of Enid Blyton as in Famous Five.
Yeah, Famous Five. That's but all she I think did about. Do All the Far Away, All the Far Away Tree and
I
the
never
Enchanted.
Read any of them.
Didn't you?
No. I only ever
I,
read
I
Famous
actually
Five.
Think they, yeah, well, see, I have such a problem with the girls just making sandwiches. Anyway, we'll get over that. I wanted to be George or Peter. But, yeah, that look, those, I think they're the best books that she wrote in that series. And I still remember being in school and my teacher reading The Wishing Chair as a serial reading, and you would sit there and be taken into this magical land. But she was drawing straight from Celtic traditions of fairies.
John, good. Hello, John.
Yeah.
Yes, John.
Oh, I was going to sort of put the idea in about adults actually believing in these, they call them fire imps, you know, if you've got a bonfire or a campfire or something, they can actually see or say they see these fire imps.
Are these the same, because we were talking about Will-o'-the-Wisp the other day, it's the same sort of thing, or Min Min Lights as well?
Yeah, Min Min Lights, yeah.
Same sort of thing, John?
I don't know, but I can't see these fire imps, but they can actually see them or believe in them. I don't know what they're,
See, there's also the idea that now we talk about people as being fae, F-E-Y, meaning they have, well, no. Well, I see it as being positive because my sister's quite fae. They have an affinity with the other world.
Oh, okay.
And so they can see things and hear things and get feelings.
Not similar to being off with the fairies.
Well, no. Well,
I'm
off with the fairies or off with the pixies. You know, I live in my own world.
But I see that as being all right in some
ways. Well, I do too. But, you know, if you want to get your housework and your gardening done, it's probably not such a good thing. But of course, that term of, yeah, she's away with the pixies, well, that really just describes dementia or Alzheimer's. It's a polite way of saying, or someone is quite ditzy, they've gone to Tiernanogog or gone to another place.
I love these stories. Look, thank you for joining us. I mean, we could talk about these things.
We
for,
could all night
for weeks
all morning.
And days.
We could.
But thank you very much. We'll talk to you about something we want to talk to you about next time. Mm-hmm. Sarah May Cox, lecturer in children's literature at La Trobe University.